The following recording is for Phoebe Silag with the Economic Policy Institute on Wednesday, April 24th, 2013 at 10:30 a.m. Central Time. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, we now have the speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given if you would like to ask a question. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ross Eisenbray.
Hello, everybody. I'm the Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute, and we've been engaged in a debate over high-skilled immigration for most of the last 6 years. We've published a series of papers about various loopholes and abuses in the H-1B and L visa programs, but the debate now is in really high gear, and we sponsored a paper, which we've just published today, by the three speakers who will be talking following me. I'd just like to say, to put this in a little context, that this debate has been really dominated by anecdote and bluster about labor shortages, and so this paper and the facts that it presents, I think, are going to be very helpful in the debate. Because most people assume that high-skilled workers are good for our economy, and therefore the more we have, the better, regardless of their immigration status and regardless of everything else, including the wages they're paid and the effect that they might have on students coming through our system, our educational system. But it does make a difference whether skilled workers are here temporarily or permanently. And it is actually possible sometimes to have too much of a good thing, and that's one of the main points that I think you'll hear today. So let me introduce the three authors of our paper. Hal Saltzman will be presenting slides to you. He's the professor at the John Heldrich School for Workforce Development and the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers. His research focuses on science and engineering labor markets, workplace restructuring, skill requirements, and globalization of innovation, engineering, and technology design. He received his PhD in sociology from Brandeis. Daniel Keene is a doctoral candidate in American University's Department of Economics, focusing his research on labor economics, the science and engineering workforce, and the economics of gender and race. Before studying at AU, Daniel was a research associate at the Urban Institute Center on Labor, Human Resources, and Population. And he has a master's degree in public policy from the George Washington University. Lindsay Lowell is the director of policy studies at the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown. He has written over 150 articles and reports on his research interests, which include immigration policy, labor force, economic development, Mexico-U.S. migration, education, and the global mobility of the highly skilled. His PhD is in demography from Brown University. So without more, let me turn this over to Hal Saltzman. Hal?
Thank you, Ross, and thank you all for attending virtually. So as Ross said, my colleagues and I have been doing research on high skill labor market and STEM workforce for a number of years, and recently decided to look at a little more in depth at the guest worker issue. It's obviously important for the current high skill immigration bill. And we wanted to follow through a couple of the key issues underlying that to understand more about who's coming in, what the impact is on this labor market. So, and at the end, there'll be a pop-up screen for Q&A for questions, as well as on the phone when we're done. It'll be run through sort of our general top-line analysis. So to start with, you know, the key questions, obviously, are, do we have enough STEM workers, and what's the role of this guest worker program? 2 points I want to make to start with is, when we talk about domestic versus guest workers, the domestic workforce, domestic students, are both immigrant and native. Anybody who's here and green card, citizen, permanent visas versus guest workers who are in the temporary workforce. And secondly, our focus is on this as a workforce issue, about the quality of jobs and employment, not the broader social immigration policies. So the key issues that I'm going to run through now are, underline this, which are, you know, are there enough STEM-educated students? We've heard a lot that we don't have enough students who are interested or pursuing STEM studies going into the workforce. What's the nature of the flow? How big is the guest worker workforce? And what's happening in the IT industry where they're concentrated? To give you a kind of an overview of our findings, they are, as we found before, just a large supply of STEM graduates. We just can't see in the numbers a failure of various colleges and universities to produce sufficient supply. And secondly, we'll go into more detail later, that it seems to work like a well-functioning labor market, that the supply is responsive when there's demand, when wages go up, albeit there's a bit of a lag because students are in school, but it does seem to function well. So to the first question, is there a shortage of STEM students? And the oft-cited statistic is when you look at global averages on tests of performance that the U.S. is supposed to be woefully lagging much of the world. We've addressed this in an earlier paper. We think that those tests aren't quite reflective of performance. But in terms of STEM, what's important is the averages don't tell us much about the supply for the STEM workforce. The STEM workforce is about 4.5% of the overall labor force. And when we look at the number of students who come from high school that go into college in STEM that end up in a STEM job, that's about 2.5%. So we're talking about a very small portion of the population that's being tested that we talk about the education performance of. And secondly, the countries that often perform highly, you know, Singapore and Finland, for example, are very small, 5-6 million, and produce sort of a negligible supply then of potential STEM workers. So we look at the global supply of high-performing students who are the STEM potential workforce. We find the U.S. produces actually the lion's share of those students globally, because we're a large country. So in science, it's large. Fewer in math, issues there, and other subjects. So the U.S. seems to be supplying large numbers of students who are available, which then raises the question that, okay, so they're available, but for some reason we hear claims that the market doesn't work, that even though we may have the potential, they don't enter. And that logic seems to fly in the face of, you know, decades of labor market theory and research that says these markets do work reasonably well. There is a lag that when students are in college, it takes a couple years to adjust, but they are responsive. So we looked at what we call two natural experiments, one in the IT industry and the other in petroleum engineering, where we can see whether there's high demand in hiring and what happens. So if you look at what happened in the lead up to the dot-com bubble to the peak, you can see that wages rose steeply. Unemployment was fairly low right up until the 2001 peak. And the result was that the number of students pursuing computer science overall doubled, so that as wages were going up, students flocked into these fields and continued to graduate in large numbers. Of course, we then have the collapse, the dot-com bubble dropped, and you can see on the right side, wages plummeted and unemployment went up. And the result was the number of computer science graduates also dropped. That's the rate of change, right? You know, a couple years following the bust, that they declined. So the market seemed to behave as one would expect up until that point. Wages went up, number of graduates went up, wages go down, unemployment goes down, students stop pursuing the degree. The other natural experiment we have, which is more recent, is in petroleum engineering. So with increased exploration, with an aging workforce, there were a lot of retirements. The industry needed to ramp up hiring the last 5-6 years very quickly, and did, as you might expect out of an econ textbook, wages rose sharply. You can look here, quite dramatically. And the result was number of graduates more than doubled. But what's particularly surprising about this is petroleum engineering has historically had a large population of foreign students, but the increase came entirely from domestic supply, or almost entirely, so that when wages went up, the students moved fairly quickly into this field. So from the cases from background, it seems that students are very responsive to market signals, which then leads us to a question about guest workers, and first trying to figure out how many guest workers and kind of the flows. Importantly, a lot of the discussion is around H-1B, but when you look at other visa categories that are supplying the IT industry, there is also the L visas, the optional practical training for recent graduates, and the recent STEM extension. So if you graduate, you get 12 months. If you're in a STEM field, you're eligible for another 17 months. And there are a number of other visa categories, but these are the primary ones that we identified that were concentrated in the IT industry. And then if we look at what happened, the flows over the number of years, you can see a steady upward increase. The H-1B is cap, as you probably know, is adjusted by Congress. So a lot of those, the changes there had to do with when the cap was changed, as well as some market demand. But you'll see in the L's and the OPT a steady upward increase. So we look at then the overall numbers for the IT industry, went through it in the paper, which is now available, and get the detail on how we made these estimates. For H-1Bs, there's been study by occupation, so we know that, and some studies of L's, and we did analysis of the OPT STEM data and make these estimates for the total number of guest workers. Since some of this is a range, we want to be conservative. We gave an estimate of kind of a low estimate and a high estimate. And we see that overall, guest workers are somewhere between a third to a half of the number of new jobs. In the blue column, we looked at the number of IT workers who had recently, within 1 year, had their jobs. They held their job for less than 1 year. We took this as a proxy for all the new hires. Probably a higher number than those that were available in the open market, and then compared that to the number of guest workers coming in, again using very conservative estimates in terms of what's there. So we would say with fair confidence that it's at least a third, probably half or more of number of new openings are guest workers, which is quite large. But guest workers tend to be a different profile than the existing workforce. In terms of age, they tend to be younger, less experienced, and moving into the entry-level jobs. So when we look further at age distribution, find it's almost the inverse of new hires, overall new hires versus new guest workers. So about two-thirds of new guest workers are young, under the age of 30, coming into that. And so when we look then at the sort of under 30 labor market, it's probably the new entrant labor market, less skilled, you see the guest workers are equal to about two-thirds of all new hires. So that it's very concentrated in IT and at the younger, probably new entrant. Wage market, some claim that it's also being used to substitute for older workers and shift down in wages and age. We then turn to see what's happening in the IT wage labor market with this large influx then of guest workers, and look at the trends first in programmer salaries. This is the rate of change since 1998, and you see it, as you saw before, climbing to the dot-com bubble, and then starts to drop, fluctuates, and more recently has been relatively flat. It's about slightly above the level of 1998 wages. So with programmer salaries remaining flat, look at what now happens to supply of guest workers and computer science graduates. As we saw before, computer science graduates decline, and the guest worker supply, however, has steadily and steeply climbed with a short interruption after the 2008 bust, but that supply seems to be coming in quite amply. The question then gets raised is it just wages that are keeping out computer scientists, or is there some other reason that they're not coming in? People say, well, this may be shown as example of how we can't get enough computer scientists. So what we went to look at here was, you know, longitudinal survey of recent graduates who are employed, who went into the industry of their field. So what you see here is for computer science, engineering, some other STEM fields, and then health, which we got separately, of those who graduate in a degree and then enter 1 year after graduation into their field. And what you see is that about two-thirds of computer science graduates go into an IT field, about a little over half of engineering graduates go into engineering. This is a drop. Historically, it's been about two-thirds of engineering in the recent economy. And by comparison, you look at health, where there's a very high sort of transition from health into health fields. The second question then asked is, why aren't those who aren't going into the field aren't going there? And add that question. And if you look at IT, what you find is about a third of those who don't go, graduate with a computer science degree but do not take an IT job and are employed, say they couldn't find an IT job. About half say they found a better job elsewhere. In engineering, it's sort of an even split. So we're producing 50% more computer science students than are going into IT. And of those who don't, a third say they can't find an IT job. Half say jobs elsewhere are better. So after that quick tour through our data, we'll just sort of conclude quickly and then take some questions. And Lindsay and Daniel can add to this. But in summary, the STEM supply seems very responsive to market signals. The guest worker flows, particularly when you take in all the categories, are large and increasing. We think they're even larger than what we've seen here from a couple of years ago. And the labor market is very responsive, but seems to have split into two kind of patterns. There's the domestic students that are very responsive to wage levels. Wage levels go up, they go into those fields, decline, they stay away. But the guest worker supply, understandably, coming from low-wage countries, is very plentiful, will continue almost despite whatever wage levels are here because they're still better than what would be in their home country. And that supply is available at wages that are probably too low to increase significantly supply of domestic students. So now, Daniel, Lindsay, you want to follow up and then we can take questions?
Can everybody hear me?
Who's speaking?
This is Daniel Keene, and there was one point going through this that I thought I'd also add. We used unemployment as one of two measures of demand for these workers, the other being wages. And one thing that you'll often hear is that science and engineering workers have lower unemployment rates than much of the rest of the workforce. And this is true, but one thing I wanted to add is that you have to consider the underemployment of these workers as well when you use this as a measure of demand relative to other groups of workers. Because science and engineering workers are well-educated, they've got skills that are going to be in the demand in the workforce regardless, and so they may be employed but underemploying their own skills because they're outside of their fields. So while I think it's an important labor market indicator that we've presented, that's important to keep in mind when you hear other people mentioning that science and engineering workers have relatively low unemployment rates.
Yeah, hi, this is Lindsay Lowell. There's a lot of information here, but I think Hal presented it pretty well. It's a straightforward message. I think in terms of the policy implications, I want to kind of echo what Ross said at the outset. We really already accept a generous number of these types of migrants. And we could talk a long time about what temporary status means and the implications for the workers and for the workforce generally and for our economy. I don't think the argument here is that foreign workers aren't good or they aren't productive. I think the argument is, yeah, I think we want foreign workers, we want employers to have access to them. But the question really is, in what amount? And is more better? And unfortunately, I think a lot of people conflate the obvious difficulties in making the system work, the kind of bottlenecks that we have in the visa system with numbers. And so we want to address the problem with more numbers. And I think Ross is right. You have to really sit back and ask a little bit, especially having been presented with the facts about domestic supply, about if you believe in the law of supply and demand, at what point is more better and how much more? And I think those are the tough questions we need to ask.